Thank you so much, Keith and Ephraim. You fit a lot of great information into your allotted time. Didn't go even 1 minute over, so excellent job. And now we have about half an hour for questions, comments, discussion with our presenters from the audience. And we'll alternate between our in-person and our online audience for questions. And I see Laura has one right here. Oh, and please state your name and organization, if you will.
Good morning. Laura Schreig, USAID. Bureau for Food Security, and thank you so much for the presentation. That was really interesting. So you talked a lot about the need to re-educate extension agents to sort of get integrated soil fertility management more accepted and adopted among smallholder farmers. But I'm wondering, and you know, the 30 years of work that you sort of explored, has this worked? Like, when you educate extension agents, is it more adopted? Like, what do the data say about that? And I ask that question because you really put an emphasis on that, but it seems like there's a lot of value in reframing the question and thinking about if this is a free, you talked a lot about organic matter and it's a free input. So what are the other constraints then? It seems like smallholder farmers should have, like, you know, they're smart and they want to get the most out of their effort. So it seems like there are a lot of incentives for them to figure that out and know the value of it already. So I think about, like, the example in Niger, where what it really took was a change in the tree policy. Or maybe the organic matter just isn't really available. So even if you educate the extension agents, it might not solve the problem. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I don't think that we've seriously addressed the question of re-education of extension agents. I'm working currently, Virginia Tech has the Innovate project that works on education. It was the third of the three of this tripartite focus that starts bringing back the whole idea of education, research, and outreach in agriculture to USAID. I mean, this is a big movement that's just restarted at USAID, huh? The education one, the Innovate, was the last of them. We don't find a lot of support amongst the missions to support agricultural education. But the essence of it is, if you've ever really been out there with farmers and extension agents, you can see and feel the gap between them. They tell the extension agent has an education, has higher status, and does not accept the value of the farmer and what the farmer has to say and brings to the table. That gap is enormous, and what we've done is we've got educational systems throughout Africa, throughout the world, but particularly Africa, that is really based on memorization of facts, and we're telling them that's science. We're telling them from our programs back here that they're doing that, and the system of education is to read notes that they got from their professor 30, 40 years ago. So it's a memorization system that's going on. We have to address that at the heart of the communication system. Science is not memorized facts, no matter how good those particular facts may be in a particular circumstance. It is an approach to investigation and discovery and testing of hypotheses. And that's where we need to be addressing things to transform whether the uptake of really good ideas that soil scientists have about how the soil works. But they've got to be communicated and translated to the farming population, and currently we don't have the types of people to do that.
Thank you. I think I'd agree with all the points that you just made. So maybe I didn't rephrase my question quite right. I guess my question is, if you did the experiment where you educated the extension agents on integrated soil fertility management, and then they went out and you had a control group where they weren't educated, would you see much higher adoption of integrated soil fertility management? Or would you not see very high adoption? And is that more likely due to issues with policy and sort of the lack of the inputs that are necessary for the uptake of these great practices that you're recommending?
Short answer is that if we do this experiment that you suggest, we could then actually test the policies in a with an environment that was better controlled.
Maybe let me add some few lines. You talked very well about this memorization and stuff like that.
There is also a new approach to extension services. By the way, the word extension services is a one-way approach that there is a teacher and a student. The new approach is a two-way. It's advisory services where there is learning from both the farmer themselves and the extension agent. And this one is that they are calling it advisory services. Now, and we come very close to your paradigm, which is very interesting, that when you go to the farmers, you are going to be learning a lot of things. They have a lot of things that they know about the environment that the extension agents didn't read in the books. Now, we did, it wasn't an experiment that you are talking about extension agents. When we asked them the messages they give to the farmers, the following question was actually related to this ISFM, climate change, and all the things about their knowledge and all that. They didn't know. That's the unfortunate thing. So had they known that, they would have talked about it with the farmers, but now it happened that they didn't know. Then we asked the farmers, where do you get the knowledge about climate change and all that? They said the radio. I know what they get from the radio is the weather tomorrow. It is not about the climate change that we are talking about. So there is a knowledge problem, and when it is addressed, I believe that it's going to address partly this problem. You also cited the Niger case. This is my baby. I mean, the government didn't invest anything, but it provided incentive for the farmers to protect trees and plant trees. It happened. We saw the regreening of the Sahel. So it doesn't begin and stop at the extension. It also goes to the institutional changes that are also required to have this done.
I can see there are lots of in-person responses to this, but we also want to make sure we throw it to our online audience. So we'll go there first and then come back here.
Yeah, we've had a pretty lively discussion online with 120 people joining us for today's webinar. There's been a lot of discussion around agroforestry. And one of the first questions is, we have Rashid Siraj. Would like to know, are there resources and or evidence for how integrated soil fertility management or agroforestry overcomes the labor constraints? And to kind of tack onto that, Woody Navin, a USAID advisor, was particularly concerned about factoring in labor costs for planting agroforestry trees.
I don't have anything particular. You address that first. Go ahead.
This is very good. Agroforestry, I believe it doesn't have a lot. Planting a tree, it doesn't take a long time to do that. You can do it in one day, but getting the seeds, there is also a problem of market of the agroforest planting materials. That's something which is a bigger constraint than the problem of labor. You plant it, and those are trees that they take a while, about 3 years, before you can even see the returns to those agroforest trees. At the beginning, they can take away part of your land, and you're not going to see the benefits maybe for about 3 years. So there is also a need to be providing incentive for the farmers to be able to plant those trees and wait for about 3 years before they can benefit from that. And that's why I think there is a need of having these incentives that they can be provided so that they can be able to invest in the agroforest trees. So the short answer is, agroforest does not have a very serious labor problem, because you plant the trees, it's there, you are not going to be planting every year. But there is the problem of long-term investment that is required. At the first 3 years, you may not see the benefits of planting those trees, but you're going to see those benefits maybe 3 years after.
Okay, a great question to add on to that would be, Mary Allen from Practical Action wants to know, how many years do the planted trees need to survive to get those cash vouchers?
Oh, no. The survival rate, again, it depends on the areas where you're planting the trees. For example, the Sahelian region that Laura talked about, in our study that we saw, the survival of the trees was low, but in areas which are humid and subhumid, the survival rate is quite high if you keep the animals away.
All right, we'll come back to our in-person. I'll come here and I'll get you next.
I'm Suzanne Pullen from USAID, the Bureau of Food Security. I'd like to make a couple of comments. First of all, I agree with a lot of the things you said about needing for re-education or in service, maybe, for a lot of extension agents. I happen to be the AOR for the Modernizing Extension Advisory Services, which is the companion for the Innovate, which works with extension agents. And the Ag Innovation Systems paradigm is exactly what is being promoted. And MIAS is coming up with a, through our one of the consortium members, Catholic Relief Services, a group of pocket guides for extension agents to learn about how do you work with farmers in terms of adapting to climate change. So this is on the radar screen and something that's coming up. I also would like to go back to my personal experience in terms of U.S. adoption of soil conservation and other things. I think Laura's point, again, if you look at, you know, in the 60s and the monoculture, fence row, corn and soybeans, and some of the soil conservation service, not just extension agents, but the U.S. had a soil conservation system with agents out there working with farmers to adopt soil conservation plans and watershed management. I know even to this day in our family farm in Iowa, my father was one of the first, he was a soil conservation person, one of the first to adopt the terracing, watershed management, the grassed waterways, all of the other good practices, and no-till. Still one of the few in the watershed with those innovation. So I don't think it's just a matter of the extension agents.
Keith has a quick reply.
I think that I've probably misspoken to some extent by just talking extension agent. Everything we said, I think, is relevant to extension agent. But what I'm talking about are innovation brokers. And that's a broader category. The extension agents are a real big, important part, and I'm really happy with what MIES is doing with that. We need to do more. But I worry about the U.S. example. The history of extension and the land grant system in the United States, if you look at back when it really got set up, it was really the sons and daughters of the farmers who went off to that local state college or university, that land grant school, and came back to help their parents' generation farm and then take over the farm themselves. They were the same people. They were integrated into the rural environment, and they talked the same language. Status differentials were not existing to anywhere near the state, particularly in Iowa, one of the most homogeneous states in the Union and maybe in the world. But it's a lot of leaders came out of Iowa nationally for all sorts of things. So it's a really good thing. The Jeffersonian idea is not bad at all. The problem in developing countries with smallholders is that they are not monocropping farmers. Number one, The economic basis and the economic decision making that all these wonderful models tell us about assumes that framework, and that's got to be thought through a lot more carefully. And a lot of the modeling does try and take that into account, but it's really tough modeling because you're trying to objectify a lot of things that are contingent decisions on the part of a smallholder man or woman who's managing their part of the household, and so that it's not the same dynamic that's going on. The decision making that farmers make in the United States to adopt these practices, although it's been challenging too, is in the context of a monofarming. The other thing I want to come back to real quickly, and then I'll just stop talking for a while, is that the network I'm talking about is highly inclusive. We're talking about those policymakers too. There's a good article that came out. I can't remember. I think in the American Association of Extension Agriculture Education and Extension back last year or so. But anyways, it talks about three different networks that are really critical. There's the local network amongst the farmers. There's a horizontal network that scales out the technology. And then there's a vertical network that works on the policy and linkages to the higher levels generalized of the system. And that the people involved in those three networks are not necessarily the same. Unfortunately, the research is based on a Dutch example, so it may not be quite as appropriate. But the idea that there are different networks, components that need to be managed, that it's not just at the farm level and the farmers that we need to focus on. It's everybody involved. They all got to be on the same page.
A question from online.
We have a question from John Russell, a principal at Eco Food Systems. He'd like to know, can the speakers or any participants point to references on multi-location, multi-year studies on the profitability of integrated soil fertility management and smallholder systems? I guess if not like a specific study, any examples?
The study that we did, they covered several countries, and we are currently doing a study which is covering the whole globe, the economics of land degradation. And we did in Bhutan, we did in Uzbekistan, quite a number of countries. We have 11 case study countries. In all the studies, the results are quite the same. So I can send a site to this study that is coming. We're going to publish a book mid of this year. It's going to come out, and it's going to be published by Springer. All the case studies that we do have them in that book. So I'll point out to the link to this study that we're doing.
And along similar lines, if you are aware of any really useful resources, I forgot to put up the contact information. Anything you'd like to highlight through our agrilinks.org platform about soils or about ISFM or farm behavior change, you can feel free to email agrilinks@agrilinks.org or email me, and we'll make sure that it gets disseminated to our audience. I'll pass it over to you.
Thank you for the presentations. My name is Michael Kettover. I've had the privilege and the heartburn of managing the Resiliency in Northern Ghana program for the last 2 years, and it's not an agriculture focus, but it's Feed the Future funded. I've got three quick comments, please. First of all, I think every year should be a year of the soil, so I just want to put my bias on the table, and that's based on the data and my own perceptions of what's worked in the field, working at the field level. I was a bit bemused by the lack of focus on green manures, the Dolico Labab, the Makuna, that actually produce the biomass that we're really looking for. I think the manure limitation is something that we know, and we've had good experiences, especially in Central America, with the green manures. Managing it is another issue, but they can certainly produce the biomass, one. Number two, with Ring, we are training ag extension agents, and it's a modest component on soil improvement before we give them the improved seeds, and that's a slow process, and we're working with the poorest of the poor, but we're also working on the way that the agents are interacting with their clients, more of the supportive supervision, and we agree that they just don't have any concept of soil improvement, and we have an opportunity there. And the third thing is, I went to a BFS Feed the Future conference in Senegal a couple of years ago, and for the 5 days, there was virtually no mention of soil improvement, soil conservation. The focus, as we know, is on seeds and on the other inputs. And I don't think any of us in this room are anti-chemical fertilizer, but throwing it on organic soil that's rich, we know produces a better product. So of the 500 plus indicators that Feed the Future is sharing with us, one would hope that there could be a stronger emphasis on this topic. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. All right, I think we'll throw it back to our online audience, and then I'll come back over here.
Okay, this question's from Elizabeth Dunn, directed towards Dr. Moore. Would you please talk a bit more about innovation brokers? Do you articulate them as external actors?
Innovation brokers. Innovation brokers are someone who has an opportunity to bring people together. And this is most important at the local level, but they operate at all levels. The social innovation people are good at this at multiple levels. What it needs to be is, it could be an extension agent, it could be an NGO leader, it's that champion that, you know, many of you have run into somewhere or other. They have to be a little bit selfless, because they've got to be perceived as neutral, because when they're not perceived as neutral, whatever they come from or whatever their agenda is, according to how the locals see it, will be seen and calculated into the way they're reacted to. So innovation brokers need facilitation skills. They it's the soft skills that we're learning more and more are required to do any job in the modern knowledge society. And what we're talking with a complex technology like integrated soil fertility management is a knowledge society type of technology. It's complex. It requires information. It requires many different partners to be able to do this. The innovation broker is the one who can translate, who can move between different groups and find ways to bring them together at the table. There's the idea of someone who knows how to hold dinners. In fact, in the book that Jerry brought, we have a chapter on just how do you hold a dinner and how do you invite everyone into that.
Jerry had a couple of follow-up comments.
Yeah, just a response. I appreciate your comments, and the Ring Project is a great project in northern Ghana. But these issues, these complex issues of soil fertility management are challenging from both the domestic political landscape, so to speak, and even with national governments. I think it's so much easier for people to grasp the idea of fertilizer and seeds, and so we often that more industrial approach is often emphasized, because it's just very difficult oftentimes to convey how we're going to scale up or scale out, widen the adoption of integrated soil fertility management. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that we see this. Initially when I came in, I often wondered, well, you know, this seems like a predominantly industrial approach that's often promoted, but yet when you talk to people individually within USAID, they acknowledge and appreciate the concerns that you raised about soil not being raised high enough, and I agree. It's not a commodity. It's not seen as part of the value chain. It's much more difficult. You know, it goes beyond people's preference for what they want to see, and more how things are communicated. Oftentimes, it's not always the case. But anyway, it's a challenging topic, which may lead into the innovation platform idea that we are widely adopting in our more systems type of research. And you talked about these different networks of people, horizontal, vertical, all over the place. And I do think that that's a very interactive, it seems like, I'm hopeful, it's a very interactive process to get away from this one-way interaction between extension agents and farmers. And the additional problem is not just having extension agents go back and maybe update their learning, but just having extension agents at all, or extension agents with resources to reach the farmers. So putting these innovation platforms together that focuses on enabling, empowering extension agents, and bringing them in with farmers on an equal footing, rather than on a teacher-student type of basis, I think I'm hopeful. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, Keith, in terms of the scale of innovation platforms, does it need to be very local, regional? I mean, are there national innovation platforms? Are we, what's the direction there?
in innovation platforms, it's a really catchy.
Yeah.
And they're at all levels. And indeed they should be. You need national innovation. You need people coming together to discuss these policy options and doing the research that is broader based to see what are the incentive systems that are going to kick in best. You need, and this is the question that you asked earlier about, will ISFM really be the thing that's adopted if you actually set up an innovation network platform at the local level? Maybe not, actually. Because maybe in the discussions between the farmers and the innovation brokers and their local market connections and input suppliers, they find out something else is really the problem that needs to be solved. And if you don't solve that problem, you're never going to get to the next one. And when we come in from the outside with our solution, it may not be the problem that is relevant then needs to be solved. And so the importance of this, we've got to have the messages on integrated soil fertility management, emphasize the soil. That's got to be one of the key roles that's brought to the table in these innovation platforms, that expertise. But it has to be done by listening to where it's relevant and how you're going to get there from here. Not how you're just going to get there, but how you're going to get there from here. And that's around the table that that discussion occurs. SANREM. S-A-N-R-E-M is you put that into your search engine and you'll find the SANREM website, and it has quite a bit of references. The last five-year phase was on conservation agriculture. There were projects in 7 countries around the world. You've got some of the comparative work that's done there to take a look at for those who are looking for those references. Okay.
Questions today. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left, but we'll try and squeeze in as many as we can, and feel free to stick around for additional networking.
Excuse me. Hi, Kurt Reinsman, BFS. I particularly appreciate this discussion and thank Laura for kicking off a lot of these questions, and appreciate the understanding of the complexities of the household decision-making process that goes into all of this. It just occurs to me that getting the message right and bolstering or retraining public sector extension services may indeed be helpful, but to the extent that the basic incentive structure for those agents themselves is a problem, lack of resources, lack of incentives, lack of accountability, all of those sorts of things. I'm just wondering, in your experience, have you ever had the opportunity to compare private company delivered extension services vis-a-vis public sector extension services? And I'm not, where the incentive structure might be different for the agents themselves. And I'm not advocating that we abandon public sector extension by any means, so just that caveat.
I think that the work on that latter question, a comparison of public and private extension services, to make it simple, can be elaborated in a lot of different ways. I don't know of any particular studies as such, and that I've not studied that in particular. But what I've seen and heard is that certainly I've seen with the NGOs, they are much more motivated when they're paid better. They have some of the similar types of top-down sort of perspectives, and that's where we need to work on that attitude. But the motivations, the incentive systems are superior. The problem is systemic, though. To what extent can we afford to finance these externally supported? I mean, the NGO, the private sector, if the private sector is self-supporting locally, we've got it made. That's the real solution. There's lots of things to work out. There's lots of interpersonal relationships in developing those networks and strong innovation systems within that, because each of the partners are going to come to the table trying to improve their own situation, and that's reasonable. And that's part of the reason to have a broker in sorting that out. But then that's sustainable. The difficulty is that governments have not been able to sustain extension services at any level, huh? I mean, they've just sort of disappeared. Some countries still have extension services. But basically, it's unsupportable. Private sector has moved in, and that's part of why you sell seeds, because there's a value added that you can start to pay for these extra services. What a lot of the marketing, the value chain stuff seems to be finding, though, is that when you pull out that middleman, the value chain can collapse very quickly. And so to the extent that we're setting up projects in ways that the middleman is a project-supported private sector middleman, we're in trouble. It's got to be articulated into the system where the system is paying for it. Putting in intermediaries that are project-supported that are sunsetted at the end of the project, it's just not sustainable. And where is the line? How do you create that? That's some of the devils in the details of doing that. But that's certainly one of the issue areas that we need to be exploring with our projects.
Let me add a point. We did a study in Uganda and Nigeria again extension agents, and we're looking at the incentives and the affiliation of the extension agents, and we found that the extension agents are affiliated with the government. We are offering more traditional knowledge, extending these improved seeds and all that. But the ones associated with NGOs, we are giving more messages about the environment and other things at ISFM. The interesting thing was this. We also compared the incentive, how are the extension agents motivated, and we compared men extension agents and female extension agents. Guess what? Women were more incentivized to work, even though their resources they have, the amount of wear time they have, the motorbikes and all that, were less than the men. So very interesting. So if you want, invest into women extension agents, they are more effective than the men extension agents.
I want to just second that on a study in Senegal that we conducted years ago and found indeed that's the case. The messages that went through, there weren't that many women extension agents, but those that were, they went to the women, they got to the household. The men and women in those households that were served by women extension agents were much better informed than those served only by male extension agents.
We'll cap it off with an online question and then wrap up.
Okay. Yeah, the conversation online has been really great. We have a lot of questions pouring in from all over the world. Of course, not going to have time to answer all of the questions, so maybe, not making promises, at some point we can email the questions to the speaker and ask for feedback. But this last one's from Gital Mbouri from World Vision DC. Apologize if I mispronounce the name. It's for Ephraim. Did the study find that farmers who apply ISFM understand the importance of getting the mix right? For example, balancing the ratio of organic versus inorganic fertilizers?
They did, and in this case, we were looking at how much they apply. We found that the application rate of both the organic and inorganic fertilizer were less than the recommended rates. But again, that's understandable. The ones who were applying the organic inputs were more likely to have livestock than the ones who don't. And in terms of inorganic fertilizer, the rates that they were applying was less. But in terms of knowledge, I think there were a lot more knowledge about the farmers who were applying SFM. They were likely to be closer to the market and also to have access to other resources of information indicated in the marketing aspects.
All right. We have the final closing comment that I'll send over to Moffat for metrics.
Hi, my name is Moffat Gugi with the Bureau for Food Security, Climate Change and Environment Portfolio. I wanted to top off basically on the metrics question. This is a thing we've really struggled with. When you think of integrated soil fertility management as well as a lot of NRM and climate change kinds of metrics, we've really struggled with this. We tried at the beginning to incorporate those things and we couldn't quite get it. Missions really came back saying this is very difficult to track and so on. So I want to encourage all our online participants as well as everybody here, if you have good ideas on metrics and so on, please engage with us. I think this is a discussion that's ongoing. We know the focus that's going to be happening on climate smart agriculture and so on. So we want to be able to see what has worked. output indicators, sort of impact indicators, as well as output impact and impact. So all at whatever level, please engage with us on AgriLinks and other venues so that we see where we go with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Malfat. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all questions, but we hope that the speakers will follow up as needed. I really appreciate all of your attendance. Thank you on behalf of Feed the Future, BFS, and the KDAD project. We'll see you for our next seminar.